On May 1, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Pat Rogozniak, will start a new two-year term as the leader of Wisconsin's court system, which includes 7 Supreme Court justices, 16 Court of Appeals judges, and 249 Circuit Court judges. She recently gave a speech at Marquette University expressing some concerns about how the judiciary is being viewed. So, Your Honor, Chief, thank you so much for coming back to Wisconsin High.
Well, thank you very much for your continued interest in Wisconsin courts.
Well, courts, independent, tremendously important branch of government. I want to quote from your speech at the Hallows Lecture at Marquette. You said there is a rising challenge to the institutional legitimacy of state and federal courts. Please elaborate. What worries you, ma'am?
Well, what concerns me is not people that disagree with an opinion of the court or writings that disagree with an opinion of the court. What worries me is the choice of words that some people use to describe a decision with which they disagree. So if they don't get the result they want, there's been a lot of harsh, rough language used in response to the decision makers. So it's as though they attack the integrity of the judges rather than the legal merits or lack thereof of the decision. So I'm totally in line with people criticizing or commenting favorably on decisions, on the merits of the decision. What concerns me is to shift the focus to something else. And I do think that oftentimes the language is very colorful that's used. Mm-hmm. And it's used in that way because I believe that the speaker or the writer knows that the press will pick up on that. It's much easier to quote language that often is witty and quite colorful than it is to actually spend the time analyzing whether the rule of law was correctly applied in the case.
Now, can we talk about one example? In your speech, you mentioned the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign.
Yes.
And I'm just going to read to you the director of the Democracy Campaign's reactions to the court's decision 8 days ago on the recusal petition.
Right.
And these are his words, ma'am, not mine. Ready? Okay. Conservatives on the Wisconsin Supreme Court continued in lockstep, blind to the damage that big money does to their reputations, indifferent to the overwhelming public comment in favor of tightening the recusal rules, and specious in their arguments about what the Constitution requires. Is this an example of speech that you think hurts the institutional legitimacy of the court?
Well, this is not as bad as some that I've seen. I don't think that he understands what the petition was all about, which would have required a constitutional amendment before you could ever have the kind of recusal that was suggested.
So it's not a rule that the court could have adopted. Excuse me for interrupting.
No, I don't believe it was a rule we could have adopted. And so, you know, I think that you get criticisms about judges that are elected because of contributions during campaigns or assistance from people during campaigns. You get criticism of judges who are appointed by the president of, or the governor because they want to align them with the views of the party of the appointing person. So I think, you know, if we're going to elect our judges in Wisconsin and we're not going to have public financing, then you have to raise money. And I think to say that if someone gives money to a judge or a justice, then that's a quid pro quo is what's going to follow. That's not the case. In my view, people give money because they think that the judge or the justice views the prerogatives and the restraints on the judiciary in line with what they believe is constitutionally required. So I think these kind of comments, they put the horse before the cart before the horse, mm-hmm. in that they imply a lack of integrity follows. That's not the case. There are people on my court, it's clear that I disagree with on many, many instances. And without naming them, I can tell you, I have never seen those justices make a decision that was based on a campaign contribution, though they have received a lot of campaign contributions from organizations that probably agreed with the decision. But the decision wasn't the result of the contribution. The contribution was a result of an understanding of the justice's philosophy on what the obligations of that justice were.
The quote that I read came from Matt Rothschild, the executive director of the Democracy right. Campaign. Mm-hmm. Do you think Mr. Rothschild has an agenda? And if so, what do you think that agenda is?
You know, I don't know him personally, so it's not really anything I can help you with one way or the other. I don't think that he's a fan of the courts from the way he writes. I don't think I've ever seen him write anything that was complimentary, but I don't really know him, so I don't know if he has an agenda.
Let's talk about the debate. You in your speech, you were quick to recognize freedom of the press.
Absolutely.
But you also said that some sarcastic comments are played out by people who haven't read the decisions,
right,
or are just trying to do damage to the institution of our court system. Ma'am, which one?
Well, it depends upon the speaker. I think that some of the sarcastic comments come to elicit public support for a position contrary to what the court has decided. And those sarcastic comments are often witty. From within the court, Justice Scalia is a perfect example. Extremely smart. His opinions were very, very well written. So if you just X'd out the sarcastic comments, they were beautifully done. You could agree with them or disagree with them, but they were really models of judicial decision making. But what was quoted? Always his sharp, harsh, tough talk. And it was quoted because, number one, he was very witty and he had a razor sense of how to play the news press and how to play other members in the press to pick up what he wanted to have said. Well, in doing that, he engaged the press on his side of the argument because what was repeated was his tough talk. And it also tended to drive public opinion in line with a position opposite to one the court had taken. So, I think that it depends a little bit on the writer, but I think Justice Scalia was a master at using the press to further an opinion that he wanted to be the majority of the court, but which at the moment was not.
Let's circle back to the recent court's decision to not hold a hearing or adopt the recusal petition of the 56 retired judges.
Right.
You were one of those that voted against a hearing and against adopting the rule.
That's right.
Can you talk about you as one member of the court, even though you're the chief, why you voted that way, ma'am?
Well, because I don't think that the recusal petition was well grounded. If you followed it through to a logical conclusion, you could end up with a Supreme Court that couldn't function. We need four people to have a quorum. In order to lop off four people, you could easily have someone make the kinds of contributions that were listed in the petition mm-hmm. to get rid of people they didn't want to sit on the case, even though they weren't supportive of that person's election. So you could really cripple the court, and that's why I think the petition was coupled with a request that we support a constitutional amendment, because you have to have four justices to go forward, and that's not ideal to have four justices. Could end up with a 2-2 split, which isn't very helpful. We have seven for good reason. The Constitution provides us with the ability, if we are all sitting, to be able to deal with problems more efficiently than we would if we set an even number. So you would have to have amended the Constitution to follow through on what they were asking us to do. You couldn't just do one part of it. And I do think that the judges who filed this petition recognize that. That's why they put them together. They also knew that the court has absolutely nothing to say about whether the Constitution is amended. We interpret it, but we don't amend it.
What criteria do you, as one member of the court, use in deciding whether you should get off a case?
Well, I believe I was elected to decide. I think that's where I start, and so I don't get off unless I'm required to. I don't know if you know it or not, but my younger daughter, Ellen Brostrom, is a circuit court judge in Milwaukee County. I am off any case she has anything to do with in the slightest. She doesn't even have to be the judge that heard the trial if she does an evidentiary ruling mm-hmm. or anything. I'm off the case. My husband's first cousin is a lawyer in La Crosse, and those two guys are very close. I never sit on anything that Terry has anything to do with. So if they're personal matters like that, then I get off the case.
You were reelected in 2013, mm-hmm. and congratulations on a new term as chief.
Yep,
is there any, can you envision any circumstances under which someone who donated to your 2013 campaign 4 years ago?
Yes.
Would prompt you to get off a case for purely campaign contribution reasons?
You know, I don't believe so. I can remember somebody asked Justice Abrahamson that question once, and she said she's never gotten off a case because of a contribution. For a while, she got off cases because her husband was at the university, and it was a university matter, so she didn't sit on those cases.
Right.
So, no, I think the contributions were lawful contributions. The legislature gets to decide. Now, the legislature could shrink the contributions way down if they wanted to do that. But no, I can't think of a contribution that would cause me to get off a case.
Do you think that would be a good step for the legislature to downsize the maximum contribution to a Supreme Court campaign, which is $20,000? It was just increased?
Yes, it was. You know, it's interesting. People don't give you that kind of a contribution. I think I got one of 10, and it was from a family member who shouldn't have given me that much but did. You don't get those kind of large contributions. So the size of the contribution, I don't know that that's helpful. But as you know, I don't believe that contributions are made to get the justice to do a particular thing. I do believe they're an affirmation that they agree with your judicial philosophy. And my philosophy is the legislature makes the laws. I only interpret them. I don't make them. And when we review legislation, I try very, very hard to do what I believe the legislature was trying to do. You know, my shortcut of what they do is they are either trying to fix a problem or confer a benefit. That's what I think the legislature does,
right,
on the simplest terms. And I think the people of the state of Wisconsin have an absolute right to elect a legislature that will proceed on those matters according to what they believe the philosophy of the legislature should be, either more conservative or more liberal or more favoring, excuse me, one group of people or another. So that's what the people have a right to do. My view is that I interpret whatever they do, but I don't make the laws. So contributions really don't have much of anything to do with my decisions.
Did the Citizens United ruling, which one legacy of it is elections at all levels, including the courts.
Yes.
We're now seeing Wisconsin Supreme Court races where total spending is $2, $3, and $4 million by both candidates and then third parties. My question is, did Citizens United undermine the credibility of the judicial institutions that you so strongly love and defend?
You know, I don't really believe so. And the reason I feel that way is, again, I think the contributions are made to support the philosophy of the judge or the justice. If you want a justice that's going to be very policy-oriented, and if the justice thinks the legislature got it wrong, they set the wrong policy, they should never vote for me. I'm not going to do that. I don't believe that's my job. And I think the people that contribute to me understand my view of that.
In your Hallows lecture, you said there are two types of justices. So go over them again. Those that think the legislature got it wrong and a right should be corrected.
That's right.
And that's not you.
That's not me.
And your philosophy is what?
Well, my philosophy is the legislature makes the laws. I interpret it. And unless the legislature created a law that is proven to be unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's the strongest test we have in Wisconsin, I'm going to let it stand. It's not my job to second-guess them on their policy choices. That's what they were elected to do.
Periodically, the debate comes up over whether Wisconsin should elect or appoint.
Yes.
Now that you, well, you've been on the court, well, you started with the Court of Appeals in 96, elected to the Supreme Court in 2003.
Yep.
Now that you've had a fair number of years to consider that issue, your position?
Well, I have to start out by giving a disclaimer because on this issue, I do have a bias. I was never involved in politics before I ran for the Court of Appeals. So, you know, if you're going to get appointed by a governor to sit on one of the courts of Wisconsin, either you have to know the governor so he can have confidence in you, or you have to know someone that's quite close to the governor to develop that confidence, because the governor gets a lot of qualified people asking to be appointed. I could never have gotten appointed to anything. So if I didn't have the opportunity to run and get out and talk to the people of Wisconsin, I would have no opportunity to ever have had the jobs I've had as a judge or a justice. So, you know, I have a bias with which I like the appointed process. In addition, if I'm going to choose between a group of people who recommend a few number of people to the governor to appoint, and that's the end of it, or the people of Wisconsin, and I can get out and talk to those people, I'm going to choose the people of Wisconsin every day.
In your Hallows Lecture speech, you said this: "We have lost a lot of our civility as a society." End of quote. Do you blame social media for that, Your Honor?
Well, you know, social media does pick up comments in a way that is more rough than the mainstream media would have printed in the past. I think now the mainstream media is tending to get a bit more rough itself, but it used to be it was more refined. Mm-hmm. Social media varies a lot. Some of the comments are very, very carefully chosen, very well done. Some of them are just, you know, whatever occurs to the speaker at the moment.
Yeah, so you said in social media we are seeing terms that newspapers 20 and 25 years ago would not have printed.
That's right.
Because they're so disrespectful and crude.
Right.
I'm sorry,
right.
Sorry to interrupt you again. So mm-hmm. Social media to blame for the law?
I think to some degree, and this is just my view, I'm not a newspaper person, I think the newspapers right now and mainstream media of all types have a real opportunity to be the source for accuracy and truth, and they have it because things that come out on social media come out usually without really a lot of underneath research. The newspapers can be sure that their facts that they print are correct, that the time they take to write an article is well spent and the article is well developed. It's not something that just flipped off in a minute or two. So I do think that when the newspapers pick up a word like, quote, swamp, and you know I was critical of the Journal Sentinel,
yes,
which I receive every day by subscription, by the way.
But you didn't like that editorial.
I didn't like that. Well, I didn't like the term. I think you can criticize a decision of the court, and that's fine. I think that's what newspapers should do if they don't agree with the decision of the court. But using a term like swamp, that came out of social media. That came out of our last political election. And that's at least where I first heard it. And then I saw it in the paper, and I thought they were picking up terms out of social media, and they did themselves a disservice. I think the papers, newspapers, should rise above it. They should be the source for the accuracy of information that they print. And they will soon develop a reputation in the public who is just overwhelmed with many kinds of social media, and they'll think, oh, well, is that correct? Well, what does the newspaper say about it? What does the radio station, what does Wisconsin Eye have to say about it? And these sources can really be a source for developing consistency and really knowledge throughout our citizens.
Do you follow social media comments on the courts, the justices, and the rulings of your court, ma'am?
Well, I am not on any kind of social media, okay, personally. I do have, I don't know what you call it. It's on my personal account, and it flips up anything that has my name or has the Wisconsin Supreme Court involved.
Okay.
And so if it gets out on the internet, I think that's when that selection
device.
You would
get a news alert.
Yes, exactly.
But you don't have a Facebook account.
No,
you
I don't
tweet.
No, I don't.
Do other Supreme Court justices across the nation?
I would imagine some probably do, but I don't know. I've not done a survey of that.
Aren't some of the criticisms of the court almost, maybe not deserved, but you understand why there are criticisms of
I do,
the court.
I do, sure.
Ethics complaints go unresolved. That leads to speculation in social media posts. I mean, that's not a good thing, is it?
No, it is not a good thing. I can agree with that, and I understand that there's a criticism of that. But, you know, that is the result of ending up with not having a full court deciding matters. And, of course, the petition that was before us would have created repetitive instances of our not having a full court for decision-making. So,
well, what about the proposal for a constitutional amendment to let retired judges sit on the court if there is no court majority to hear a specific issue?
Well, I think the voters of Wisconsin elect the Supreme Court justices. So if that kind of a choice is made, it has to be made by the voters of Wisconsin, who would then be giving up their right to have the people they elected sit on the court. So I don't really have any opinion about it, but it's not for me to decide. You know, that would take a constitutional amendment, and that, in the end, is always up to the voters.
Yesterday at the Assembly Judiciary Committee, they were holding a hearing on Assembly Bill 137, and Representative Gary Hebel, who's an attorney, again noted that there's, I'm paraphrasing, there's a cloud over the Supreme Court, one justice, because Justice Gableman got $150,000 in legal fees from Michael Best and Friedrich when he was the subject of an ethics complaint. Now, is this part of the public discourse that does undermine, I'm going to go back to your term, undermine the institutional legitimacy of the courts, ma'am?
Well, you know, Gary and I are old friends. His son was my law clerk for a year, so we know each other quite well. I understand that that's his view, and I respect his opinion. I don't think it really undermines the credibility of the court because he always expresses his view in a respectful way. I don't happen to agree with him, obviously, but he does have a right to that view. I'm familiar with it, and as I said, we are old friends.
But the day that the court dismissed the new recusal petitions, Representative Dana Walks, Gary Hebel, and Chris Taylor, all Democrats, all attorneys, came in. And Mr. Hebel also said that our Wisconsin Supreme Court, 15 or 20 years ago, was one of the most respected in the nation, and it is no longer so. I want to give you a chance to respond to that.
Okay. Well, first of all, he's looking at some old data. Our court is still routinely quoted by Supreme Courts throughout the United States. Our opinions are very, very well reasoned. He's responding to political pressures, I suppose, that favor a change that was not made by the courts deciding not to go forward with this rules petition. And I respect his position. I just don't happen to agree with it.
Should someone assume then that all judicial rulings are based on the merits and not influenced by any political tinge at all, Your Honor?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. If you take the time to read the decisions, you will find that they are based on the rule of law. We ground them in what the statutes say, what the Constitution says, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. That's what judges do. Now, do they have a political overtone? I don't think we get into those things that are quite that hot on our court generally, but the U.S. Supreme Court does, and I did comment on that in my Hallows lecture. You know, there used to be a doctrine where if something had heavy political overtones, it was called a, quote, political question, yeah. And the courts just didn't decide it. They determined that the decision on those kinds of issues was really left to another branch of government, so they just didn't step in. Well, that was when I was in law school. That was Baker versus Carr. Now the courts are really selecting, and when I say the courts, mostly the U.S. Supreme Court is the one we look at with this kind of a discussion. They're stepping into areas that are hotly political. Certainly Bush versus Gore. How could it be more political than to have the U.S. Yes. Supreme Court
determining
step in
who the next president's going to be?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And our presidents are partisan selected. They're not independently run without a partisan tag to them. And we now have a number of cases that are making their way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Wisconsin has one of the pack going forward. And the claim is that by redistricting, there has been, quote, political gerrymandering.
Yes.
Some members on the court believe that that is a political question, because redistricting is constitutionally assigned to the legislature, at least in Wisconsin it is. I haven't done a survey of all 50 states. I know some of the others are. I don't know if all are in the same spot. But they're taking it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's certainly, I mean, and it's either a Republican or a Democratic plaintiff in these cases, and it differs because these cases are going on throughout the United States. So what the Supreme Court will do with that, I don't know, but I think one of the reasons you get this political tinge is there are cases that have political overtones. In the past, the courts would never have gotten involved. Now it appears with the leadership from the Supreme Court, that's not such a bright line anymore. So I think that sort of feeds into all of this as well.
Is there more or less collegiality on the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the 2 years that you've been the chief, Your
Well,
Honor?
I think more. You know, I've tried very hard to get each of my colleagues to pick up a particular area that in the past was decided and led only by the Chief Justice. I've done that because I work with six very smart people. They were all elected by the citizens of Wisconsin. So I've asked different justices to take charge and report back to the court on various items. For example, I asked Justice Gableman to be in charge of our relationship with the Native American tribes of Wisconsin. He visited every single tribal court in the state. That never has happened before. Now, some of us have visited some, but he visited every single one. And he's invited the tribes to be more participatory in what goes on with our circuit court, what goes on. We had a meeting about 2 weeks ago with the Supreme Court and all of the tribal judges. So, you know, he's really done more than one justice could do. I could never have done that. I have too many other things to do. Justice Annette Ziegler is in charge of education. So she's been very involved in moving education forward. Are the judges really looking at the latest developments in the law? Are we keeping up to date, or are we just repeating with judicial education those kinds of programs that have gone on in the past? Now, some of that we need to do, but we also need to be up to date. And some of the areas I have stayed very closely involved with myself. I'm very interested in article in parts of the court's administration that involve children and families. Right now, our Children's Court Improvement Project is working with courts that focus on how to help families by recognizing the trauma that the families go through, and that by making our decisions informed with the knowledge of that trauma, we can do better for the children and better for the families of Wisconsin. So I think we have more collegiality.
The reason I ask was this last comment by Justice Abramson as your last administrative hearing ended. Maybe we need therapy, she said.
Oh, she was kidding around.
Okay.
Justice Abramson has a wonderful wit. And it pops up all the time.
How would you describe your relationship with the former Chief Justice?
I think it's good. You know, I knew Justice Abrahamson before I was ever a lawyer. So, no, I think she contributes greatly to the court. We don't always agree on legal issues, but her opinions are well-reasoned, they're thoughtful, and I think she has a lot to contribute.
In your hallowed speech, you said the court is nonpartisan.
Yes.
But does that mean then that justices shouldn't go to county or regional or state political conventions? Because covering these conventions, I've seen justices of the court. Does that send the wrong message, Your Honor?
You know, I'll tell you, we have a rule that talks about that. It does say that you can go to all these things when you are a candidate. I wrote in dissent to that rule. I think it's unconstitutional. I thought it was unconstitutional when we passed it, which is why I voted against it. Judges have a right of free association. It is a First Amendment right. We have Supreme Court cases that specifically say you don't give that right up when you become a judge or a justice. We have a judge in Milwaukee who wanted to become a member of the Democratic Party. His right was upheld by the federal courts. So I don't believe in the rule to begin with. I think judges should be out in the community. I think if they are, it will really promote the institutional legitimacy of our courts. I think a lot of people that criticize the courts simply do not know what the courts do. They don't know why we have a certain decision that comes out. They don't know what constraints there are on our decision making. You know, we just can't take a case that comes to us and flip a coin or decide to do it the way we'd like the result to come out. I write opinions that I don't like. I would like a different result. But really, you know, my job is to interpret the law. It's not to make it. And if I wanted to be a policymaker, I would have run for the legislature, but I didn't.
In 2016, the Republican Party of Wisconsin offered to help Justice Rebecca Grassl Bradley. Did that make you shudder as someone who cares about the independence and nonpartisan of the court? Should Justice Bradley have said, I don't want this help, Republican Party?
I think members of the Republican Party are voters of the Wisconsin, just like members of the Democratic Party are voters of the state of Wisconsin. You know, when I ran for election, I went to the Jefferson Day dinner in Milwaukee, the big Democratic to-do, and I went to Lincoln Day dinners, not because they were partisan events, but because that's where people gather. I also went to PTA meetings. So did Justice Rebecca Bradley. I also went to Rotary meetings. So did she. You go where people gather. The fact that they gather at events that are partisan shouldn't really make any difference.
And someone in that audience shouldn't conclude then that you at that time was a member of the other Republican Party?
Well, they could have asked me, well, they could have looked me up and they would have found I wasn't. But yes, that's
okay.
Right.
Two final questions, so we're out of time. The Joint Finance Committee is going to vote on a potential pay raise for judges and justices. Are they deserved?
Absolutely.
As it's been years since pay raise?
It's been a very, very long period of time. Yes, a long period of time. And in fact, you cannot get a pay raise for a judge unless the legislature approves it, because the courts, though we set the salaries for our own employees, we cannot set a salary for a judge. That has to come through the legislature.
And then my final question, Chief, is if this continued trend of challenges to institutional legitimacy of state and federal courts continues, and the rhetoric gets even more harsh, what will the courts be underpinned and even in a worse state 5 or 10 years from now, Chief?
You know,
look out.
I would ask us all not to try to assign blame for what has gone on in the past, as John F. Kennedy said, but to accept our own responsibility for how the court is perceived in the future. And I think all of the judges need to get out in their communities. I think they need to speak at Rotaries, at PTAs. They need to explain what a court does and what a court can't do. I really think we have an opportunity right now to increase the judicial legitimacy.
Chief Justice Pat Rogenczak, good luck on your next 2-year terms as Chief Justice, and thank you so much for visiting with Wisconsin Eye.
And thank you for your considered concern about the courts. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.